Hello, my name is Hayden Prowse.
And I'm Julian Rubinstein, and this is News Roast.
And today, we're not going to introduce our guest.
No.
She is going to do it herself. Cue guest.
Hello, I'm Rose McGowan. I've been cued to be your guest. How would I describe myself? I will tell you this. My favorite color is burnt orange. I directed a movie called Dawn. It's really good. It was nominated for Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. I grew up in a strange situation, but then I think everything is strange. I grew up in a cult in Italy. There, now you know. I wrote about it in my best-selling book.
Best-selling book.
Klaxon.
Brave. In which I compare the cult I grew up in to the cult of Hollywood. Also, I'm more of a Boston Terrier person than a cat person, although I formerly had cats.
I was about to ask that one. Shit.
Okay, now it's your turn. Is that enough of an intro?
That was a great intro. And just to give a bit of a sort of preamble, I saw Rose McGowan very recently at Hay Festival. She did a fantastic talk.
He tackled me.
I tackled her afterwards and said, would you please do our podcast?
And he texted me and told me it was happening. Said, this is not going to happen.
Yeah, Joel was like, yeah, all right, mate.
All right.
Not only that, but I rescued Hayden and his friend Hassan, and they wound up sleeping on my floor.
Are we going there, are we?
Okay.
Fantastic.
The good news is we had a great drive to get there. It was epic.
We did. Yeah.
Well, listen.
We swam in a river.
I'm very jealous of your river times and your house times, but I do want to say what a massive honor it is to have you on the podcast, leader of social change in our time, someone who speaks truth to power, and just, you know, I was also a huge Charmed fan.
Yeah.
So also, just this is just all good in my book.
Ticking all the boxes. I mean, the thing that I wanted to start off with, perhaps as our sort of first course, was that the thing I hadn't known and realized when I saw the talk was you grew up in this incredibly unusual situation in a cult. And the way what you do in your book is compare the cult that you grew up in as a child to the cult of Hollywood and the way that's kind of all affected our lives in terms of the media we consume and the culture we sort of swallow without really questioning it. And I thought perhaps we could talk about that as our first course, if that's okay with you, Rose McGowan.
Yes, Hayden Prowse.
So, cults. What is a cult? Are cults all around us? How do you define a cult?
How do I define a cult? I define a cult by any structural situation or system that you're living in that you are a part of without really fully realizing you've given a ton of your power away to a system that isn't inherently benefiting you. And if you're supporting that either emotionally, financially, psychologically, you are part of a cult-like structure. And so for me, like, the reason I compared what I grew up in, the children of God, to Hollywood was because I realized there are vast similarities. And also, you know, I use Hollywood as an example, but there are those structures all over the place. You vote for Trump, you're in a cult. You're hard Brexit, you're in a cult. You're hard not Brexit. If you're hard pretty much anything, doing something that doesn't actually benefit you. Let's say you're a woman at work and you're complicit and setting up other women or really only doing something to help, say, the male boss. Or maybe if that situation was reversed and there was magically a female boss and you were reporting, but this person was doing, say, nefarious things and you're supporting that. Or you're supporting a thought structure. I think it's more, I mean, it's deeper than that. Like for me, I have a perspective, I think, that is a bit unique because I got like the hardcore. They came at me really hard and aggressively from zero with thought constructs. And I think because they were so extreme and because I saw that their actions weren't matching what they were preaching, I realized later that pretty much everybody is in that system. Let's talk about religion, of course. And doing something that fundamentally betrays the idea of being a free human.
So what is it that people get in return, or they think they get in return for giving up that freedom? Because whenever I see documentaries about cults, I find it so hard to get it through my head how someone could give away their agency like that for something that just doesn't appeal to me. And I get your sort of comparison between cults and Hollywood, and like in you know, it makes total sense. But I don't question Hollywood. Like, I completely understand why people go to Hollywood, give up their agency for the thing that they think they want, which is fame and money or whatever. Like, what are the comparisons between those things, and how are people sort of betrayed in that way and sort of, you know, brainwashed?
I guess I think that when it's just like anything, you want to belong to something, I suppose, which I also don't really, I don't have that that kind of emotional makeup. I guess it was, I wasn't given a choice. I was born into it. You know, my father was the leader of the Italian chapter, kind of like the Elks Lodge or something.
Yeah.
And I think they want something different, and it's a reaction to the bigger cult that's more watered down.
Right.
So most people aren't aware they're even in it.
Mm.
Because it was so obvious, you know, I could see all the parallels. Whereas I think people that are just organically born into the system, which is most everybody, let's take the West. We'll just use the West as an example here. Most everybody born into the Western kind of civilization or society has been so conditioned. When I went to America at 10, and I mean, they came at me really hard to conform my thought to theirs.
Yeah.
And luckily, a year later, I read a Malcolm X book. I said, why would you let your enemies teach your children?
Yeah.
So I set about not letting them teach me anything other than, you know, access to books that I did.
In the cult.
No, and the cult was actually interesting. They were an unusual cult in that they really prized the mind.
Yeah.
But they also trained us for the end of days starting at 16 months.
Right. So what sort of teachings were these?
But
were these sort
of the teachings doesn't Christianity do that?
Yeah, of course.
Of course. But I mean, in terms of this cult, just to understand, because obviously this is all news to me.
Right.
Was it sort of, you know, the teachings of Osho or Gurdjieff, or was there a particular sort of thought structure they were following?
That was probably the number one thing that alerted me to the fact that this was some bullshit when I was little, was that I couldn't actually get a solid read and never have on the belief system. I could never lock down what it was because it was so malleable and it changed depending on the mood or the day. And there were always new dictates coming in, new dispatches for behavior from the leader, David Berg, who was renamed Moses David by himself.
And this still exists today, does it?
Well, he died, but it's reformed, still all over the world, and they've rebranded as the family, which I kind of feel like, as somebody who understands media pretty well and branding, I feel like I should reach out to them and suggest a different name.
From the family.
I just think that's
kind of creepy.
That's quite. Yeah.
Well, the family's broken, isn't it, as well? Everyone knows that.
No, but
the normal 2.4 children thing went out a while ago.
Yeah, that does ring alarm bells, doesn't it? If you go to a group of a bunch of people and they're like, come in, sit down,
we're the family.
It's like, dude, that was used in Godfather. Like, you've really got to think of like a new way to roll that.
I know. I'm like, let me help your Instagram page.
Yeah.
Rebrand. You offer them to help them with your Instagram.
I'm like, reach out and be like, I know you're creepy weirdos, but let me tell you something.
Yeah. It's strange, though, on the American thing. So I had an ex-girlfriend who, her father was from North Carolina, and she had a younger brother who'd grown up in the UK and then went to America, and the teachers called their parents in and said, look, we've got a real problem. Let's just call him Ben for now. His name's not Ben, but we've got a real problem with Ben. And they were like, what is the problem with Ben? And he said, you know, the problem with Ben is he doesn't have the fear of God. And their parents were like, I'm sorry, what? And he was like, look, we ask him to stand for the national anthem. He won't stand for the national anthem. We ask him to do stuff.
That's interesting, because that's about what Rose talks about in her book. She was, I mean, you should talk about that, because you just didn't accept the teachings from like the age of, you know, 2-3 years old.
Yeah, that's the fear of God. It's hard. The first word that comes to mind is like a long stream of curse words for that. But North Carolina, the general, America's a cult. Let's be real, hard cult. Like, if you believe in exceptionalism, America, which is hard to prove. You know, the book, I do talk about, my book, I talk about how the first day of school in America, they changed my name from Rosa to Rose. A couple minutes later, they said, you're going to stand for the national anthem or the Pledge of Allegiance. And they made me stand in front of the class. The teacher manually put my hand on my heart because I didn't know what they were talking about. I was from a cult in Italy. And I heard them say, we're going to get the commie out of her.
Wow. They actually said that to you. We're going to get the commie out of you.
It was a naval base. It was a Navy school. It was a military school. And they put a pink shirt on me and basically informed me that I was a girl because I was raised without mirrors. Mm. So my...
You were raised without mirrors. What, you didn't have any mirrors in your house at all?
It was a place of like 200 people. No, it was, you're supposed to shed external self. We were raised as superminds.
Wow.
And we were not raised to be a race or a gender. So my perspective on things is kind of the ultimate outsider.
Right.
So my perspectives on gender roles and things like that, I just find everybody's like kind of real. And maybe it's easy for me to say this because I don't present as, you know, say a trans woman or a trans male, but I think even so, like, they were born into a system that I was fundamentally not born into. Mm-hmm. And I was raised to not see myself externally. Of course, later I became a sex symbol and that one of the most photographed people in the world at one time, and that will fuck your head up.
That's bizarre. Yeah.
Can I just ask, like, from an outsider's point of view, I went to uni in America for a bit, but I'm just really intrigued to know, what do you think people who aren't from America do not understand about the American school system? Like, what is it creating?
And I don't know if you do this here, but I was the biggest insult to my intelligence and everybody else's was just their steadfast dedication to homogenization and lower level homogenization. You know, I also talk in my book about what I really see as a metaphor for America, which is American cheese. Orange. Why? Why is it orange? Who decided? Who told us? If anybody there, if you said, what's American cheese? Orange. Why? What the hell? Did you ever question that it never came out of a cow that color? No, you did not. You know, it doesn't. There are so many holes in their logic. And what I saw was just this really aggressive determination to stamp out individuality, aggressive determination to stamp out freedom, freedom of thought. You're allowed to read this because you're this age. You're allowed to do this because you're this age. They would constantly, in one school, try to bust me for reading ahead of the class. I'm reading silently. Did it really actually matter to that teacher that I was reading 20 pages ahead? But no, I would have to keep my finger 20 pages back. So when the teacher saw me reading ahead, and she'd be like, Rose, and I would get to pick up exactly where they left off. So I had to keep one ear out for what was being read, you know, by the slow reader. But they always want to give a chance to in class.
I mean, your country.
Nothing against slow readers. It's just hard in class.
Your country's just elected an orange American cheese, isn't it?
Hey!
Hey! Yeah, it's a real cult-like structure. And he is, you know, he's not even a good cult leader, for God's sakes. But he is. And what they do is they reinforce the same words over and over. They reinforce the same trigger words. They tell you what you are and what you think and how you should behave. And they do that under penalty of being different. And then people get afraid of being different. And I posit that it's okay to be the weirdo. I was tortured every day in American schools, except for then when I went to another school where I was lauded. One night I went to another school in another state where I became wildly popular for no reason that I could discern. I was also wildly unpopular. I could understand that discern that reason. It was because I was different. And to be fair, I did look kind of like the evil woman in Superman 2 that fell down to Earth. I had short, dyed black hair when I was 12. I took myself to the boots of America and dyed my hair black. And then was like, I think I just wanted like a solid, like, I do not look like you.
Right.
I can't be you.
Yeah.
You're right. Your sense, but they would literally, these would be adults in this state, Oregon, and they would try to run me over with their vehicles. The worst thing I got, because and they would just freak out of the cars. And I was like, at this point, say 11. How threatening is an 11-year-old to your idea of what you're supposed to be?
It's interesting. Talking about that sort of homogeneity and like the way in which Hollywood is complicit in that. It is, I mean, like, this is something that I've only started to begin to question. You know, I think it's become quite prominent largely because of the Me Too movement, people questioning female roles in cinema and the inclusion rider and all this sort of stuff, and rethinking who our protagonists are, why they're always male, all that sort of stuff, which is super, super important. But one of the things that I was saying to you at Hay was that I feel like I've only just started to rewatch these huge American blockbusters and have reevaluated what I've been taught to be as a man.
Correct.
And it's fucked. Like,
it's super. If I were you, I'd be very mad.
Right. Well, the things that I feel like I've always you know, put as my ideals and the things that, even very subconsciously, the things that I need to be as a man. When you really unpick them, you know, whether it's James Bond as your protagonist or bloody Superman as your protagonist, these are the people that you look up to as a kid. I mean, Julian's obsessed with the Avengers films, but like, what are those superhero characters telling you about what it is you need to be as a bloke?
What are they
imprinting
in the world?
Jordan Stevens, who I'm doing quite a lot of work with on a thing at the minute, you know, put it really well in this article about toxic masculinity, where he was like, James Bond, you know, 23 movies where he shoots and kills constantly, leaves women by the side consistently, and is just running away from his childhood trauma.
Right.
You know, but it's like we held that up, because you're totally right, as this kind of bastion of super cool,
he's the ultimate
manliness.
Emotion. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And because I completely agree as well. And I think, you know, one of the realities, whether you want to call it toxic masculinity or not, of like unpicking your own patriarchal, sort of patriarchally infected reality, going back to the earliest sort of teenage images, because you are advertised
it's
to
than
so
teenage.
Well, totally.
It's
I mean, earlier. But I think that's where maybe you start actualizing. Mm. I think, you know, and maybe it is
there's
earlier.
A 2.5-year-old then. I was telling Hayden the story that I saw on Facebook, and it became super viral, and he was punching, like he was doing these moves with Sylvester Stallone, Rocky, and he was just punching and punching, and then it switches into Rambo, and he takes the gun, and he's like, you know, doing the gun face and fake shooting, and the kid at every move perfectly choreographed to the TV screen that was playing behind him.
Right.
And that's 2.5. And I was like, everyone's like, isn't that cute? I'm like, no, you just told that boy what a white male is. That's not very cute at all. You just trapped him in a construct.
Yeah. It's fascinating, because there was a friend of mine who made I'm not going to say who it was, because it may have negatively affected her career.
All these anonymous friends of yours.
No, but it's important in a way, because I guess some of this is, but she made a film with Damian Lewis. Mm. And basically, great film, was received really well, but its message was basically about religion. Mm. And it was basically about an abusive priest who had a ward that he mistreated, the ward then went off and took magic mushrooms and had a sort of psychotropic experience where he connected to nature and his wife. And it was an amazing story. She thought it'd done really well. It was looked at by people in America, and they were like, not these messages messages about religion, not these messages about drugs. And they basically quashed the film. Mm. And I sort of, you know,
they
I suppose
not cotton to freedom of thought though.
But that's a strange thing, right? Is like, I don't think we have thought for years about, I mean, obviously there was Crash, which quite famously took on that just the issue that, you know, there was the scene with the Mexican character, and it was like, oh no, a Mexican can't say that because that's too intelligent. But really, it hasn't been questioned properly, has it? I mean, is it something that you think is being actively questioned now?
I do. Very few people ever go up against the film industry. You know, I opened my book with a story about this actress named Frances Farmer. She had done one movie, maybe a couple movies, and she was very popular, but she hated it. She hated Hollywood. This is the 40s. Right. She was colluded against by her mother and the head studio boss to be given electroshock therapy to force her to want to be famous, which is to force her to want to stay in the cult. And these messages, you know, I think one of the things that people don't understand, I would say, about me, or the broader point that I make, is a lot of people think I do what I do for women. And of course I champion women. Why wouldn't I? I love the underdog. But who does my heart break more for? Men.
Men.
Really?
I feel so sorry for them. I look at them and I almost get claustrophobic a lot of the time. I get, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. If I had one life, that's what it's going to be. That's what it's going to be. Oh my God, no. And I start panicking. I start like kind of freaking out. I would certainly feel more for them if they didn't like rape and kill us all the time. But I understand it.
Mm. What is it that you think?
Talking about psychopaths.
No, sure.
I'm talking about, you know, 60% of gun violence deaths in America are women. Partner violence, right? So, and they keep that statistic hidden. So they market it as everything's inner city violence. Don't worry, they're just killing each other. They'll take care of themselves, which is atrocious. The thing is, though, is that men organically, they're never given the space to goddamn be human.
Well, this is
are women.
That's fascinating.
This is a crisis right now.
I don't think people need to focus on being better men.
Yeah.
I don't think women need to focus on, I think, be a better goddamn human.
Yeah. Well, this is what we need to redefine. And I think it's really important, because when you're talking about gender roles in cinema, I think it's, we've got to be careful not to just make women versions of men. You know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, they're both psychopaths and they kill people and they walk away and they don't care. That's not what we want to see, presumably. We want to be able to see men being able to redefine themselves in a different way. You know, it's okay for men to be able to say that they've had bisexual experiences, for instance, right, which is a very difficult thing for a lot of men to talk about, especially growing up in our generation, like perhaps 10 years later, and it's a lot easier for young guys. Right. But then, you know, and there are these pressures, and I don't think it's coincidental that, you know, the biggest killer of men under the age of 40 is suicide.
Yeah. Oh, well, country. Because it's like you blow a gasket. Yeah. You literally, you're the engine block cracks.
There's some fascinating sort of information coming out about this at the minute. And again, I did this talk recently with Jordan. Who's great.
Letters
right?
Live with him. Hey,
and
he's
amazing and he's good.
And he still gets it.
Yeah, he really does. And he went on a course where he actually tried to unpick his childhood trauma. And I think a lot of the fact is that, like, you know, unpicking and understanding our childhood helps us as all as adults.
But you get re-traumatized. That's what people don't understand about trauma. Over and over and over. And it re-triggers it and re-triggers it. And if there is such massive, rampant sexual abuse, and there is in boys and girls and every, you know, flavor under the sun, we're walking around as an incredibly wounded society. And yet we're all wearing the skin of the people that are supposed to do good and fit in and be good people. But the reality is, you then see, say, a Harvey Weinstein's face, and it triggers everybody, boys and girls alike. Okay? There is... So fundamentally, a problem, if I started looking at everybody on the street, I get so many people, probably 50% of my support online is men, easily.
Really?
And 50% of the people telling me about being hurt, I would say men.
I think the thing I was trying to sort of draw attention to is sort of emotional intelligence, as correct, in like looking at the brain.
Well, that's not really raised either, is it?
No, and this is what I mean about kind of essentially looking at the brain. And this is something we've discussed a lot on the podcast, because, you know, I'm a big believer in therapy, about sort of just essentially, look, you go to the gym,
unpack
for your body.
It.
You go to, and I had an incident where I was, this weekend I was at a music festival, and a friend of mine is just going to therapy for the first time. And literally one of my best mates, who I've known really well, he turned around to her and he just grabbed her shoulder and he went, "What's wrong?" And I thought, that's what's wrong. That right there, that actually the it's like an admission of weakness. Like, I'm going to therapy. And his immediate reaction was, "Oh my God, something must be really wrong with your situation." Whereas I'd been in a dialogue with this person for months saying, look, it's just a really positive thing to go and start a dialogue with yourself.
It is. But if you flip the frame of that, instead of saying, "What's wrong?" What do you want to go more right?
Exactly.
What do you want to be better?
But I think it felt like an accusation.
No, it does. And then you're on the defensive.
And that's what I mean is, and I could see her close up as a result of just hearing that. And it wasn't negatively intended.
But we do everything. Like, what happens when you cry? And if someone has a box of tissues, what do they do immediately when you start crying? Do they push that box of tissues towards you? What does that tell you? Shut down your emotion. I'm uncomfortable. Let the people fucking cry. God damn it. Let them cry. Let him cry. So what, you have water on
delegate
your face?
It to
big
the
deal. Right. No, they push that across the table. Yeah. Like, here, stop.
Here, have some tissues.
Here, have some tissues. Yeah. So the person's then trying to, like, push it back down.
I've never thought about it like that.
It's so interesting, all the things you're talking about and unpicking. I refer to it as unpacking in my book. But I talk a lot about, and this is where, you know, my expertise comes in, because I would watch my father wire people's minds.
Wow.
So my book is about unwiring. My book is about getting you, a lot of people, we're beset by fears. For me, I try to get people to look at the tapestry of their life. Okay, if your life is a big tapestry hanging up against the wall, what are the threads in it that are yours organically and what are synthetic? Get those ones out of there. What are the ones that have been planted by, say, Hollywood? What are the ones that have been planted by your parents, who were implanted by their parents, who were implanted by their parents, who have all likely been hurt on some level, of course, because we all have.
They fuck you up, your parents do.
They do, but they're doing it because we all know, but it's not just them, it starts in on you. You know, I talked about this at Hey, but they did the study of like 11-year-old boys, and they said to the 11-year-old boys, what do girls run like? And of course they, you know, their hands are like flailing about and like doing the girl run. Then they asked 5-year-old boys, what does a girl run like? And they just ran. So something's happening between 5 and 11.
Yeah.
But I also talk in my book about the fact that you guys, whether you agree to this or not, before your feet hit the ground, I mean, if they can do a scan and tell what sex you are, but once you're born, Oh, yeah, golden ticket. Hey, man. Yeah. You get this really comfortable chair under you that's invisible. And there's something in Hollywood called the imposter syndrome. Or famous people. They talk about it a lot with famous people. And they say that they have a lot of them suffer from imposter syndrome, especially the male actors, because they have to think they're all tough and everybody thinks they're this way and they're secretly really not. And you have to present this false front. But I'm like, well, why is that just relegated to people that are famous? Wouldn't that stand for everybody that's masquerading as somebody who's not damaged?
No, totally. It's interesting that you talk about that and in relation to the whole incel movement, which obviously you know about. These guys that have been committing these massacres because they are, I think one of the biggest sources of sort of, you know, male resentment is this idea that we're given that the world is due to us. And if we don't get what we're told we're due, we react in an aggressive or violent way. We throw our toys out of the pram. And it's really interesting how gender roles have been changing in Hollywood for over the last 20 years.
Not too much,
but to the extent that
I know people behind it.
Let's take the high school drama, right? Used to be that there were the jocks and only the hot guy and the hot girl got together.
Right.
Then this sort of quote unquote revolutionary change happened where suddenly the geek got the girl.
That made it even worse.
Well, this is what I'm saying, because the geek always got the hot girl still. So the girl's character still hadn't changed. She still had to be like,
trust
hot,
me, I would stare at these was. Guys that they would write for me to kiss, and I'm like, you gotta be fucking.
And so what we're doing is we're still speaking to young males saying, no matter what you are, who you are, you still deserve the super hot girl.
Do you understand that where that comes from, though? The nerds behind the scenes.
Right, who are writing the...
Yes. And when I was at the head of the ex-head of studio's dinner party, I told you this, everybody went around the table, and it was almost all men. And they were asked, we were asked to tell, like, what's the worst thing that happened to you in your life? What's the worst thing that happened to you in your life? And I'm like, well, I'm going to win this conversation. But it went all the way around. And by the time it got to me, I started having a panic attack. I was like, oh, my God. Ah. Every single guy. And they were all like nerds. Nerds with power. And every single one of them was like, well, I was a late bloomer and I was 13 and none of the girls liked me. This is their life experience. Wow. And these are the jerk-offs that are making thought for you. And they want to rewrite their own story. They want to write that the schlub gets the hot girl. Why? Because they didn't. You're still mad about it. Wah. How about this? How about we get rid of all of the constructs and step back into being human?
It's really difficult because...
But you have to unpack.
Yeah.
If you have a thought... And you're enraged, or you're, but it's not. They have so much. Those incels, they're just beset by fear. Fear runs them.
And there's this really interesting sort of, again, something that I've been looking at a lot, which is a lot of people say that basically rage is the lid on depression, and depression is the lid on grief, and these emotional containers that we have, that when depression pops, it turns into just all out rage. And I think that there is such a lack of emotional clarity that most humans have, because it is definitely not English just language. Men who've got a problem with emotional intelligence. You know, there are plenty of, you know, female friends or girlfriends.
I thought I had discovered how to have emotion and talk, like one of my, an ex, I thought I'd figured out, and I was still very bad about expressing emotion. Emotion in terms of that hurt my feelings and this is why. Not castigating you, not coming after you, but this hurt. I couldn't do it. I would just go mute, and it was like my voice would come from the middle of my stomach but couldn't come out of my mouth, and I would just turn to stone. So I thought I'd struck on the perfect way. First of all, he was British and went to Eton. So that gives you, I was like, So he sat on one end of the couch and I would sit on the other, and I would text him how I felt because I couldn't articulate it out of my mouth. And by doing that, though, I grew to be able to identify, like, instead of just freezing up when something happened to me. I wasn't raised with any grace period for emotion in a lot of ways. We didn't have – there wasn't that. But at least I was not trained, like men are, from so little, that you're only – the valid expression is to be funny and sarcastic with your friends or rage-filled at a football game. These are sanctioned, especially in America. guess a sanction. I broke up with the Etonian because I realized, I was like, I'm pretty sure I can change the world, but I don't think I can fuck with British history like that.
Can't fuck with the British establishment.
I can't. I'm like, the Etonian, I'll just let it go. That school system, I'm like, that's just too much for me.
That's the biggest cult.
Y'all figure it out.
That's the biggest
cult. We've made a career out of those kind of like sarcastic remarks and stuff like that completely, because I mean, I was bullied as a kid and I thought the way to make friends was to be funny.
Right.
You know, like, as in like, and
diffuse the situation.
Totally.
I am at my most comfortable when I'm being sarcastic and cutting in a situation. Yeah. And he will tell you this. And as soon as Joel's a lot more open with his feelings than I am. And every time he'll try to talk to me about my feelings, I'll just say some like little sarcastic comment. I had a therapist that was
like, you need to stop making jokes about everything the second you're about to have an emotion, Rose. Yeah. And then I went to Ireland and I was like, oh, hey. I'll do that. It's called gallows humor. Mm. But it is also, it robs you. It is your own internal Kleenex box being pushed towards you. Mm.
Joel.
Hey.
We have to stop the podcast for a second because I'm quite excited about this. There's a fantastic new play coming to the Playhouse Theatre about the Calais jungle. And I know the guys that are doing it and it's fantastically exciting. I'm very excited about this.
So this is the play about the jungle, right?
That's right.
Which is set in Calais.
It's set in the Calais migrant camp, which is the refugee camp that became known by the same name. You probably remember it. It was started in March 2015, destroyed in October 2016. It's an immersive theatre experience, which I think is fantastically exciting. People can go and feel what it's like to be in the Calais jungle.
It's a very strange thing, isn't it, that it only really was a camp between March 2015 and October 2016.
And so many moving stories there, having been there myself. I met these guys. Mm. In fact, I met them on the day they set up their theatre.
Did you?
It's written by a guy called Joe Murphy and Joe Robertson, who actually, they lived in the camp for 7 months.
Wow.
And they established this theatre, which I saw them setting up, called the Good Chance Theatre. This was originally set up as a space for sort of expression in the camp for young refugee actors who came through and needed a way to sort of, you know, express themselves and get some of the traumatic experience they'd gone through out.
Not being a total snowflake, but it's actually where I actually broke down. I saw these kids just playing a drama game.
Yeah.
And it just totally fucking broke me. It's
emotional
ridiculous.
Stuff. If the play's anything like that, I'm sure it'd be really good.
Good for people as well who never went there and actually sort of maybe had their own doubts, because I imagine some of the stories are...
Get some Daily Mail readers down there.
Hopkins, free tickets for Katie Hopkins.
It's co-directed by Stephen Daldry, no less, and Justin Martin, whose work you're probably already familiar with through their own individual projects.
What's great about the show is that the Playhouse Theatre, where it's going to run, will undergo a complete transformation in the true immersive style, and will feature the Afghan Cafe, which was one of the many restaurants on the camp, taking the audience right into the heart of life in the jungle.
Ticket prices start at £15 and 40% of the tickets on offer are just £25 and under. It's getting 5-star reviews across the board, so make sure you head down to thejungleplay.co.uk for more details and to reserve your seats.
That's thejungleplay.co.uk. Boom!
I think you should... I'm something you mentioned at Hay, which I thought was really interesting, and people that don't, you know, work in film won't necessarily know about this, but the descriptions that you get in the script when sent the script for a film, and how they differ between men and women, and also, you know, demographically between different races as well.
Completely. The stuff that most people will never see, some of the most egregious stuff in screenplays is before it even makes it on the screen, is, you know... The like Tracy, 22, sexy, not too slutty, but on the line. And or mom, 57, spends most of her time gardening and doing laundry. Chuck, 28, a hardened man who can take his gun out at any time as necessary and shoot what hurts him.
It's true.
Like that crap, and you're like, fucking it. And then for the races, it'll be Matt, 27, blah, blah, blah. Antoine, 22, African American.
So you don't need to say if he's
white.
If he's white. That's just
that's
a given.
That's a fucking totally norm, isn't it?
And I started like, and I have like, you know, screenwriters that I've worked with, you know, in the movie I directed, and they sent me a script they wrote, and they did that.
Yeah.
They did that race thing, and I sent it back to them, and I said, justice, you either have to put race for everybody or race for nobody.
Yeah.
I suggest race for nobody.
Can I ask you a question? Do you think that it's good, though, that they're better or move in the right direction? There's a guy who we've interviewed a couple of times on this podcast called James O'Brien, who's a wonderful sort of truth speaker in this country, and he's got some daughters, and he puts a lot of their ferocity down to growing up with characters like Hermione Granger or Jennifer Lawrence's character in The Hunger Games, empowered female protagonists who are sort of driving sort of classical stories forward. Do you think that's a positive thing, that those sort of characters are existing, or is that just a bit of a
Why do these female characters need to have guns in order for them to be
empowered?
Well,
let me tell you, in the original Harry Potter book, I'm pretty sure, and there's no knock on Emma Watson, it's not her fault, but, you know, Hermione was chunky with fuzzy hair.
Was she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do I think they're good? Of course. Anything that has intelligence and strength, true strength. One of the things that I loved was actually the Black Panther film. To me, that was actually the best example that I've known recently of female strengths in it, because they weren't just – I realized, and it was interesting, that the female characters don't come in for a little bit in the movie. And when they came on screen – I always look at people's body posture in theaters. And women, including myself, you kind of like push yourself back a little bit. Like, okay, I see the woman entering. What's it going to be?
Right.
What are they going to do?
What, like horror Madonna sort of vibe?
Correct.
Again.
Which way are they going?
Mm.
And to my joy, each female character was incredibly strong and in a superhero movie, complex. But in each had their own individual ways of being complex. It wasn't like across the board uniformity of like a stock character in any way. They gave a lot of thought to different things. They gave agency. You know, they let the person be the person. They just happened to have been born with that body. And that's really my message at the end of the day. That, but also, you know, Me Too was like, for me, taking out the trash. My movement is intelligence.
I want to get on to what you were talking about previously about like imagining a sort of more constructive, I guess, more profound Hollywood experience when people go to see
Correct.
These movies. How do you do that?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, and I said this, it's 96% males in the Directors Guild of America.
White males, mostly?
I would probably, this is a rough estimate, probably 84%.
Mm.
That is fucking nuts, isn't
it? But that statistic hasn't changed since 1946. I mean, yes, there are other races now, but as far as the male man-woman spread, that the 96% dominated by men hasn't changed since 1946.
It's insane.
So you've been fed a steady diet of a bunch of nerds who are hostile to women and come there to be sociopaths because business isn't sexy, but they can be businessmen and shoot damaged fish in a barrel, and I mean pretty boys and pretty girls.
Mm. So do you think when we have a more diverse group of people that are sort of creating these stories for us,
yes.
we're naturally going to be able to define ourselves in more complex, more interesting ways?
Right? Yes, but it's not just them. It's the people behind the scenes. It's the power brokers themselves. I wish I could tell you these people were better. I wish I could tell you that they were
smart. The producers, the financiers.
Dear God. Like, I know people in the writer's rooms, you know, at some of these shows, and they're like, oh, we need more sex. Can you write a rape scene in?
No way, really.
That's sex. That's not sex. That's abuse of power, stupids. You know, let's take a look at the movie with Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. What, the Nice Guy, or Nice Guys.
Nice Guys.
Right? The opening of that movie shows an 11-year-old boy reading a nudie magazine, and he's staring at, you know, a porn star. And the movie takes place in the 70s, right? And the next thing, crash! This Corvette comes crashing through the trees outside of this boy's window. And then he goes down there to check it out, the crash. Oh, my God. You'll never guess who's naked on the hood of the car. Dead. The porn star he was just looking at. Oh, my God. Whoa, mind blown. And then we go into the Russell Crowe, Ryan Gosling of it, right? They make jokes repeatedly throughout the entire film about the dead whore, the dead hooker.
Right.
But they needed to get their quota of nudity in. But she's dead. I mean, it's so mind-blowing. You know, like when I outed this Adam Sandler thing, I got this script that was like the part that I found most offensive about what I was written on the cover letter to the script was, besides it just being an Adam Sandler movie, What is, huh? Make sure you read the script so you understand the context of the scenes. Like, it's an Adam Sandler film. Jesus Christ. And then it said, dress sexy, push-up bras, parentheses, push-up bras encouraged, no white pants, tight leggings also encouraged, you know, I'm paraphrasing. And I knew instinctively it was a woman that wrote that. And as it turned out, it was.
Why?
Because that's who would be the people in the jobs that type things.
You know, I'm minded to ask you, because we obviously have limited time, what do you make of the way Instagram has kind of taken on these tropes, and then it feels like kind of super sort of right. charged them? You know, because
I
mean,
don't think it's taken on. I think it's just a different medium for it.
Do you think so?
But now,
I suppose it's just girls on their own, though, without going to a casting couch.
But when I was, no, of course. But they're fully indoctrinated into a cult-like system that fundamentally is not helping them. They have been completely externalized. They're completely sexualized. When you, I walk down a street in Miami and I see the girl with the hair weave and the nails, you know, some white chick, and she's got extensions on, and she's got the fake nails, fake boobs, fake tan, stretchy skirt, high heels. I'm not saying you can't look like that, but I'm just saying think about why you look like that. Is it for somebody else? If so, why? At what point were you sexualized? At what point did you think that was your entire worth?
It's interesting. What do you think about, you know, the sort of, there was a debate a while ago around Emily Ratajkowski, who posted a very sort of sexualized image of herself, I think, in a bath of spaghetti. And there was a debate around whether or not that was a feminist sort of, you know, statement she was making. What do you feel like there's something that kind of, you know, people overly sexualizing themselves all the time on Instagram, and, you know, the sort of Kim Kardashian phenomenon of, like, do you think there's some kind of contradiction there, some paradox, or do you think that?
I think it makes it hard. It's, you know, there's a lot of nuance in things, and people have to be allowed to be people, do whatever they want. As long as it's not really hurting others, then you can say, is it hurting others? It's a tricky one, but what's good about it is that it sparks conversation. But unfortunately, most of the conversation comes with, like, slut-shaming condemnation or, like, I want to jizz on you.
So true.
Do you
that's
think...
That's not really nuanced
conversation.
There's nothing
wrong with positive sexual relationships.
But
there's nothing wrong with, like, you know, being highly sexed.
And there's nothing wrong
sexy.
With being like, hey, like, I look hot in this photo. Of course,
yeah,
that's
I'm
fine.
Feeling myself.
I'm feeling
good.
Myself. I feel good today. I think it short-circuits Emily... You know, before Instagram or Twitter would have been framed and sold how I was, which was purely external, without at least any form of her even being able to say I'm a feminist or I am this or I am that. What you see a lot of is the end result of years and years and thousands of years of conditioning.
Can I ask you, on staying on social media for a second, because a large part of the movement that you started is intimately connected to social media, and obviously there's a huge power in it for you, but what do you think the problems are with social media? You know, both what you were just talking about the superficiality of it in some senses, inherently, you know, you can't really have a debate on Twitter, for example, because of you're limited in the number of characters that you can use. And also the whole thing about bubbles, and you find yourself often speaking to the people that already agree with you rather than the people that you really want to get your message to. I mean, it's been incredibly important for you.
No,
and
it's
your
a
movement,
double-edged sword. It's very hard. You can't really fully express yourself, but it's more than I was ever able to before.
Mm.
And, you know, it's interesting. When I was banned on Twitter, when they shut down my account, I had someone tweet it out for me that I had been shut down, and there was a Women Boycott Twitter, like, in all over the world day, which was cool. But I think for me, they did someone just did a study and found I have a really huge amount of Trump-supporting young millennial women.
Really?
Hashtag MAGA, hashtag Rose Army.
Wow,
amazing, isn't it?
It is actually good.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And I tell them, I say, go back in my thread, go back and read more, go back and read more. When retweeting people, I have to be very careful that they're not Nazis.
So how do you talk to them?
There's that Nazi retweet.
No, because I've almost retweeted some that say amazing things. And then I'm like, not just like, you're so great, not like that, but like revealing like details about themselves. Thank you, this book made me braver. And then I go on and they have like Trump with an eagle behind the head. I'm like, for God's sake.
Right.
But It's a fucking start, because my movement is thought. My movement is 10% more consciousness. I don't care who it's from. I want it from everybody.
Well, I think that's perhaps even more important it that is. You're talking to people like that than the people that were already converted to the same.
I don't need to. Yeah, people completely. Are like, people are like, why don't you get Lena Dunham to support you? Lena right, Dunham well, can rot. Right. She's fake but, as fuck.
Sure, but you don't need to convert Lena Dunham, do you, to the,
no.
to, you know.
Lena Dunham was, like, Hillary had Lena Dunham campaign for her. That worked out well.
Yeah. Do you think, that it's interesting, this.
I mean, say what you really think, Rose. I mean, don't come back for anything. Do you know what I mean?
I don't.
No, I can tell.
Because I don't really care,
that's
fundamentally.
That's the classic British irony there I was employing. I know. I don't know if you saw that, but just with a small.
Oh, no, I completely understand.
Because that's what I find difficult with subtle. Twitter, apart from being fucking dyslexic, so I misspell everything. And then people are like, you're not your.
Okay,
you
by
pricks.
The way.
Also, you I'm pricks not... who say that shit, fuck off.
That's me.
Stop tweeting. Well, enough.
That's my favorite.
It's hard. Well, it's usually because someone, when they're saying you're misspelling your, they're insulting you.
Yeah.
So it's harder to take you seriously, I have to tell you.
I know, it's very difficult for
me. My favorite thing to do.
My sister's a dyslexic, but also a rocket scientist.
As a friend of mine said to me, and it's true, you can never, with anything that's texted, it's the same on WhatsApp or whatever, you can never see a like nice tilt of the head.
I'll say that. No, but I'll write something and I'll say, by the way, I said that with a soft smile.
Right.
See, that's good. Yeah.
That's it. I was having beef with my the guy downstairs in my flat the other day, and we were texting, and it was all really, oh, you know, you're up all night, and you left the door open. And
I saw it you?
No, it was all him.
Oh,
but,
okay.
And I was being a shit, and then I saw him in the hallway, and I was like, oh, hi, man. And he was like, hi. And I was like, how's your day? He was like, oh, it's fine. And we had a really nice conversation, because
so
I couldn't be
also,
mean to him in the real
Glover
world.
Donald Glover did a brilliant thing on this in Atlanta, yeah. You know, and there are a couple of bright sparks I feel like going
oh,
on right
definitely.
Now. The This Is America video was just so incredible.
I think he's an incredibly great. Important
Me too.
Figure in the world.
He's becoming so, and also Beyonce at Coachella, I thought was really good, you know, female empowerment. As sexy as fuck and unbelievably empowered female role model talking about sisterhood, because, you know, this is sort of what I think is so important is about what you're doing and what you're saying is, you know, it's about being human. It's not about
I'm so,
a
yeah,
divide between the sexes.
I'm fundamentally bored between the sex, like men are from Mars, women are, I'm like, oh, shut up. I've been bored by this shit for so long. Aren't you all? Because I know I am. And watching the same, you know, for me as somebody who was really has met more people than most will in 20 lifetimes. And realizing, you know, that if I was in The Wizard of Oz, I was trying to figure out who I would be. I was like, who am I? Am I a munchkin? No. Am I Toto? No. Am I the wizard? No. I'm the curtain.
Why are you the curtain?
Because you pull it aside and you realize Wizard of Oz is just a fake.
Not just that. The curtain plays both sides. The curtain is sold to the public that's staring at it before it opens the main attraction, you know, before it opens the images for them on the screen. The curtain parts say, right, metaphorically or literally. The curtain's meant to just look pretty until it gets, like, you know, tattered and then gets replaced. But it studies both sides and it's silent and it absorbs all.
What?
Social anthropologist, I mean, you know, I feel like I could earn that title. I've imitated you. People long enough.
What color curtain are you?
I've always seen it as this kind of burnt gold.
Burnt gold curtain.
Yeah.
That's a nice, is it like a velvety curtain?
It is.
Yeah.
Actually, not too shiny though.
Not too shiny. Yeah.
And a nice weight. Not. Yeah. But what I did was pull the curtain down. But the thing is, like, on both sides, you're disregarded as a woman, you know. I've had so much semen sent to me in the mail, I really can't tell you.
Are you actually joking?
No, smeared on my windshield.
Fucking hell.
I've had, like, 2 years ago, a male producer jammed his tongue down my throat, said, I've always wanted to do that. And that's exactly to what you were saying, which is, if men are sold this idea that take what you want, conquer, like, you know, obviously how you've seen Conan, you know, striding through town, grabbing the wench, throwing her over the back of her horse, and then you're expected to go out and figure that you can't do that, but you've been told you are owed everything because you can stand when you pee or some other reason that I can't discern.
Mate, even earlier than that, like He-Man, Thundercats, like
all of it,
all the stuff all we watched as a kid. Like, I do think, like,
but
it's really fascinating
to
meet you, because I feel like a lot of it has sort of made me look back at, you know, 10 years of just, you know, being a guy and, like, looking at it and just thinking, like, wow, there are so many micro signals that maybe I was over completely and unaware over of. And over. But that's one of the most positive things I think that's happened is that yeah. kind of global reevaluation.
And it was really
that's
cool.
unbelievably healthy, you know?
So healthy. We needed to have a conversation, you know, because the English language, especially to me, is so limiting. Happy, sad, mad, glad. Oh my God. You're like, is that like, that's like kindergartner language that we haven't advanced? How are you feeling? Happy. Are you sad? Oh my God, there's no nuance in this language. It's so dull. I can't take it. Mm. But the thing that was really cool that happened to me on the way here, actually, I was walking down the street and there were two businessmen looking people. One of them was looking, I'm not sure who he was looking at, but he was like, oh, those tits. And then I heard the man next to him say, don't do that. That's not being a good human. Mm. Bam. That's it right there. That's the only thing. The message is so simple.
It's so interesting hearing you say that because, you know, you are the sort of figurehead of this entire movement that has changed the world. And a lot of people's misgivings about not just that movement, but all sort of social media-led movements, whatever it is, whether it's racism, whether it's sexism, is that there is a level of sort of outrage or there's a level of simplification of the ideas and condemnation without discussion. But when I talk to you, you're like, you're so nuanced about it. Like the way you talk about it is all about nuance. It's all about getting, having the discussion and being able to have that discussion without just being like, rah! Like it's like, we need to sort this out together as a society.
Correct. And otherwise we'll never get anywhere.
Yeah.
But also, and it feels like it's also about peace. Like, as in, it's actually about actually like convergence rather than, you know, making two forms disparate and actually about emotionally healing the issue rather than sort of actually, you know, inflaming it.
Mm. Do you guys have lobbyists here like they do in America?
Oh, yes, we absolutely do.
So, I was a lobbyist. I was volunteering as a lobbyist in D.C.
When was this?
A couple years ago. And I... oh my God, you'll really appreciate this. Mm. I took off when I basically announced myself as an activist. I infiltrated as just a pretty girl to pretty celebrity person to sit at the table at this giant dinner in a museum. And it was for lobbyists. And at each table was one of the most powerful people in Washington, both Democrat and Republican, didn't matter. So you know that worm guy, Mitch McConnell? I don't know if you've seen
him. Yes.
The guy with no neck. He, lolly worm, but uglier.
Mm.
More evil. He was there across from me. He stands up and it was, this is so American politics anyway. He goes, wow, this is a really nice museum. I mean, never been in a museum before. I mean, 9/11 museum I've been in, of course. And then
that is just amazing, man.
And I was listening to all these turds, Democrat and Republican, and I was like, oh my God, I'm in a room with the Kool-Aid pushers. I'm in with the OG, the real pushers. Ah! And it's like that Led Zeppelin. Ah!
Yeah.
Like going off in my head, and my heart was racing and racing, and there were no cameras, so they're all speechifying, they're blowing each other for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all, a couple would talk about their single mother, almost every single one, because they each took turn at the table, the powerful one standing up and speaking, each man, they're all men, each one said they needed to figure out new ways to leave more money to their sons.
Fucking hell, man. It's just.
And I
like,
was like, it is. But so when I was a lobbyist, and I quit pretty quickly because I was like, this is not complicated. I was doing it to learn the ropes because I've really been conducting a 20-year social reengineering project on my own. And I decided that there were no lobbyists for thought, and that there are no lobbyists for bravery, and there are lobbyists for courage, and there are no lobbyists, certainly, for nuance. And I thought if we're advancing society, quote unquote, with automation, all the time, faster, with faster technology, faster. Has nobody confronted the idea of being more intelligent?
Mm-hmm.
And in America, you're a suspect if you're an intellectual. Now, I'm not saying you need to be an intellectual. I just want people to be at least 10% better. Now, what that means is if you're afraid of something, like, oh my God, if I don't get this job, I'm going to be homeless, and people stop and they have that fear, that's the hamster wheel. It goes around in their head over and over. Okay, now let's go one step beyond that. What would happen if you didn't get that job and became homeless and say you were not someone with mental illness? Would you be able most likely to figure it out? Would you be able to get your way out of that? Most people would. Most people.
They would be able to.
Not, I'm saying like people like you. Right. Or me, we would be able, people that like have.
Privileged people.
Mm. I'm not talking about like domestic, you know, violence, like abused women that are getting cast out after the husband takes over the bank account and everything else and destroys them. I'm talking about like just traditional average people, right? Not the ones that are skating on the fine line. But we have those fears. Even the most money I ever had in my life was at the time I was most afraid. And it gave me such anxiety. And conversely, I had been homeless when I was 13 and had 25 cents and felt a great peace. I'm not advocating homelessness. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying we go to these like catastrophic fears in our head, and then you have to think, or like, oh my God, if I say this, then this will happen. Then what? Are you going to put in a timeout? No. Like if all the actresses and actors that knew about all the shitbags behind the scenes came forward, it would really just do a nice cleanse. But they won't do it because they're scared. And I'm like, scared of what? What are they going to do? Put you in celebrity timeout?
Celebrity timeout.
Or just like they'll be like publicists would be like, oh, you can't wear that on the red carpet. It's too editorial, which means too fashiony. It has to be more red carpet, so it can appeal to the middle of America. I don't want to be disposable nail salon fodder in Hello Magazine. I don't want to be in People Magazine. That's a lose.
What are you going to do now? What's your, because you've written this book.
I'm starting another book. The next book is called Trust. And it's really looking at so much of mine has been taken from me. Well, I never really had it. I was never able to. But because I had the Mossad infiltrate my life last year, and they're trying to put me in jail in America.
Mossad?
Black Cube, look it
just,
up.
Just a bit off the cuff, just drop that in. What happened? Oh, Black Cube, because of the Weinstein thing.
Yeah.
Right. They're the ex-Mossad guys who were investigating you.
Just investigate me. They masqueraded as other people and infiltrated my life.
Yeah.
My literary agent was secretly working with Weinstein behind the scenes to get me to sign an NDA. There's just so many levels of complicity. It's wild. But what that's left me with is I either have to trust people 100% right off the bat now or never. It's kind of actually was so diabolical, all the treachery. Even my attorney was secretly working with Weinstein behind the scenes.
Holy fuck.
My attorney for keeping Weinstein away from me.
That's a lot of
not an entertainment attorney. So many, you don't even know. The story behind the stories is like incredible. But so now like it's actually kind of given me a gift in a weird way. It's kind of a superpower to start at the top of trust and to work your way back instead of starting from the bottom and working your way up like we're told to do.
So is that what the new book's about?
Roughly, yes. Also, I have an album called Planet Nine that I produced and sang and wrote and put it together all over the world while writing the book. That was kind of what kept me sane. And the visual art project that goes along with it. I also have a skincare line I've been working on for 10 years that's finally getting ready to come out. And it's incredible. And I looked at what I looked at with the beauty industry is everyone comes at it, you know, critiques it for like selling us unreal images, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, sure, of course. But I think it's actually incredibly classist. Why do the fancy products get sold to the rich people? The poor people have to go to the pharmacy and get chemicals. Why? But it's the same L'Oreal behind the scenes making both at the same chemist plant.
Well, I bought some anti-aging moisturizer recently. And answer me this. I don't understand why you need a different moisturizer for under your eyes your forehead.
This is the sort of shit that blows his mind.
Is it bullshit?
No, it is. And let me tell you why. But they do it on purpose. So they
because they can sell you more moisturizer.
No, not just that. Oh. That too. But of course, that's the goal. They take up more products. But it is true. So the only, my skincare line, it's incredible. So what I decided to put something out at a price point that is neither high nor low, that addresses, that says, like, that has incredible ingredients in it, science and nature. But we didn't put something called a nanosphere in there. And what the nanospheres do in regular traditional face cream, they're like these little bubbles.
Right. They're very environmentally damaging, aren't they?
No, not those bubbles.
Oh, okay.
These are just bubbles you can't, these are little things you can't see, like microscopic, but they clog up your pores under your eyes if you use regular face cream. So you get these white bumps under your eyes called milia, and they're like little calcified deposits. So it forces you then to go buy an under eye cream so you don't have milia.
So
you just don't put the nanospheres in there, thus you will not have them.
After Rose, one of the most profound statements I've ever heard, and we got straight onto, listen, what's the deal with eye cream?
No, it's true though, but it's the whole point of it. So the only, actually use under your eyes, on your face, and on your body, because it's all bullshit.
Right. Only use under eye cream.
No, use under eye, right. The lotion, my product, yeah. Use it under your eyes, on your face, and on your body.
Well, okay.
Why should your body be treated less well than your face? It doesn't make much sense.
Discriminating against my arms in favor of my forehead.
You are. You're discriminating against your feet. And I really think you should consider that.
I should consider my feet more.
If you've enjoyed News Roast, and we are coming to the end of this series, you know, please, please do subscribe and follow. Next week, which is the last episode, is a live episode with Buddy G, a.k.a. Asim Chowdhury, a.k.a. the Mayor of Hounslow. We hope you enjoy that. It's been a great series of News Roast, but we do need your support, so please subscribe to the podcast, share it with your friends. But honestly, Rose McGowan, you've blown my mind. Thank you so much for being a guest on News Roast.
Thank you, Rose McGowan.
Thank you Mr. Rubenstein.
There she goes.
Thank you, Mr. Press.
She did it right.
Namaste, motherfuckers.
Do you know what? I was recently in India. Namaste. I figured out what it really actually means.
What does that mean?
My soul recognizes yours. So namaste, everybody. Namaste.